The recent court decision declaring the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional has set off a national debate. A three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit ruled last month that the phrase "under God" violated the separation of church and state. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about what the pledge actually means.
Here's the odd thing about the pledge, that people can take its wording so seriously at the same time they find it charming when people get it wrong. It's classic Art Linkletter stuff. I led a pigeon to the flag, and to the republic for witches dance, one naked individual. And nobody seems to mind that even older students are unclear on the meanings of words like allegiance and republic. In fact, it's often said that the very obscurity of the pledge is what makes the phrase "under God" constitutionally unobjectionable. Back in 1984, Justice William Brennan described the phrase as a form of ceremonial deism, which has lost through rote repetition any significant religious content. You heard that argument a lot in criticisms of the Ninth Circuit decision. Newsday described the pledge as a harmless civic recitation. And in the Washington Post, Mark Fisher wrote that God's name is just a frill, a space filler in the unthinking torrent of daily conversation. To hear some people tell it, you might conclude that there's not much difference between saying "one nation under God" and "one nation by God." But if the pledge is merely a harmless civic recitation, why the torrent of invective over the Ninth Circuit's decision, to the point where some op-ed trombones were comparing it with a straight face to the September 11th attacks? As columnist Cal Thomas wrote, "The court inflicted on this nation what many will conclude is a greater injury than that caused by the terrorists." And even if most people would find that comparison offensive, there's no question that the indignation over the decision was very broad and very deep. Of course, the pledge isn't the only obscurely worded patriotic text that can evoke strong feelings. The Star-Spangled Banner is famously unparsable. How many people could tell you with confidence what ramparts are or why anyone was watching them? And I'm sure I wasn't the only school child who wondered why we were singing a song to "My Country, 'Tis of Thee" when everybody knew we lived in America. But the pledge is the only one of those texts that was actually written for recitation by schoolchildren. It was composed in 1892 by Francis Bellamy, a socialist clergyman, as the centerpiece of an elaborate Columbus Day ceremony sponsored by the National Education Association, which was designed to promote the use of the American flag in the public schools. Bellamy made no concessions to the linguistic limitations of his young audience. Those obscure words, "I pledge allegiance," were intended as an allusion to the oath of allegiance to the Union that many Southerners were required to sign before their political rights were restored after the Civil War. But the words wouldn't have had much meaning to schoolchildren in the 1890s, 40 years after the war had ended. Nor would children have made much sense of Bellamy's original wording of the end of the pledge, "with liberty, fraternity, and equality for all," a phrase that the sponsors rejected as too radical and too French. Granted, that was an age that delighted in high-blown patriotic language. Late 19th century schoolchildren were expected to memorize and declaim patriotic speeches like Patrick Henry's "Give Me Liberty" and Daniel Webster's "Against Hain." But the pledge persevered even after those exercises were dropped from the curriculum. And in fact, its syntax grew more convoluted as time went by. Bellamy had originally written, "I pledge allegiance to my flag." But in 1924, that was changed over his objection to the much clumsier "The Flag of the United States of America," this at the urging of the Daughters of the American Revolution, who were fearful that immigrants might take the reference to "my flag" as ambiguous. The pledge became even more opaque when the "under God" phrase was added in 1954 to emphasize the difference between us and the godless communists. Whether or not you agree with the sentiment of that addendum, it's hard to defend its syntax. "One nation, under God, indivisible." It isn't just that the phrase disconnects the modifier "indivisible" from the word "nation." It's also not clear exactly what "under God" is supposed to mean. The phrase was taken from the Gettysburg Address, but Lincoln used it as an adverb. "This nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom." Whereas in the pledge, "under God" was somehow changed to an adjective, which leaves its meaning up for grabs. Does it mean we believe in God, or that we're subject to God, or that we have his personal attention? But then, that vagueness is probably what commends the phrase in the first place. School teachers sometimes try to explain the pledge to their charges in words that they can understand. I promise to be true to the symbol of my country, the United States, a single country where people believe in a supreme being and which can't be split apart. But most people would resist any effort to change the official wording to something more comprehensible. We like the pledge as it is, in all its turgid opacity. As Eric Hobsbawm once observed, patriotic rituals aren't supposed to be transparent. They're there to provide the emotional signs of membership in a club, not its bylaws. All that talk about harmless civic recitations gets the pledge wrong, because there is a point to having children gather in collective surrender to sentences they don't really comprehend. That's where patriotism takes its most irreducible form. When it comes to the crunch, it's a question of da-da-da flag, da-da-da America, da-da-da God, da-da-da liberty, da-da-da for all.
Jeff Nunberg is a researcher at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information and the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now.